Okay, so it is Sunday, April 19th, 2020, and I am with my friend Ryan Richardson. Ryan, say hello.
Hello, everybody.
And Ryan, here. What are you?
Let's begin.
You are here. Class B.
My seatbelt is on. I am ready for a cheap flight. I have my beverage in hand, and we're ready to go.
It's a cheap flight from Windsor to Milwaukee.
It is.
So let's talk about your beverage in hand. What do you have in hand?
The beverage in hand today is coffee with what we call over here a mud shake. It's called a vodka mud shake. So it's probably half coffee and half mud shake. I don't know if we've even discussed this before, but I'm lightweight. I'll admit it. I'm open with that. Most of the time when I go out to eat, when I order a drink, it's usually got an umbrella in it, or it's got like coconut or pineapple in it. So I'm a lightweight.
So the foo-foo drinks.
The foo-foo drink, yes. So I actually have, it's probably got like 0.5% of anything potent in it, but it is quite tasty. We normally have Bailey's in the house. And so usually the Bailey's and coffee is such a great combination.
And, it is a very great combination.
Yeah, yeah. We used to watch the show called Banshee, and we'd watch it on Saturday afternoons, and we'd say it's Banshee and Bailey's. That's our day. So, but there was no Bailey's.
That's amazing.
There was no Bailey's to be found in the cupboards. Today they were bare.
So yeah, that's we got to put that on the list. But today, what I am drinking is a water with just a like a cherry juice added to it because last night we had a virtual karaoke party for one of Stephanie's good workmates, and I had just plenty of local craft beer. So
okay, yep.
Rather than chase that hair of the dog right now, I'm just going with water. I'm hydrating.
The hair of the leader dog.
The hair of the leader dog. Love it. So this is what Ryan and I talked about before we were rolling. We're kind of mapping out what we want to do with this kind of mini series, if you will, of where I just talk directly with Rai. And one of the things that we think are it is at least interesting to us, which is good enough for us to record, is to just to go to the background of leader dogs. And so to do that, we've decided that today we will get the background of Rai. And then in the coming weeks, so that we can like learn how he met Jeff, we'll have Jeff on and how he met Derek. And then when we, after that week, then we can get back to your first connections with leader dogs, because that's when the story kind of takes off from there. So just be fun just to kind of go down memory lane a bit. And it'll be fun to get the other guys on and laugh with them and try to compare stories and reconstruct what history looks like, for
the real story
for this group. Right.
Memories, and if I still have memories, that's the test. Well, it's almost like a quiz to see if I really remember what happened and how it happened. And if the stories line up.
If we don't have those other guys on, then your story is the truth. So we'll just.
Exactly.
So Ryan,
first one wins.
A couple of weeks ago, when we tracked and remember audience that we tracked and didn't end up publishing it because we had some technical difficulties, but in that, part of the reason I want to go back and just go into your history is because you said some really profound things about your life and the culture that you were in and how you were drawn to music. And I'd love to just, drill into that because I think that that's a very interesting story. So let's just start with, the history of Rai.
I've been called a lot of things in my life, but profound is not one of them. So thank you very much. I was born in a small farming community in Canada, raised in an igloo, and the sled dogs would take me to school every day.
I forgot to cue up the ba-dum-psh, Ryan, today. So No, but I will say this, though, because I want to make sure that you include this in your story, because this is something I found very interesting. I think we got onto that topic because Bill Withers had just passed. And so,
yes, we did.
And that got you thinking about your connection to music. So anyway, I don't want to I don't want to,
tell
your story, but why don't you go ahead and just give us the background of RyRy?
Yeah, I was born into a relatively small Canadian community. No sled dogs, no igloos, but that's what everybody else thinks Canada is, so that's okay. I'm okay with that narrative. I was raised in a family where music was extremely important, and part of it was a soundtrack, and I always go back to that for myself. What's the soundtrack of a particular time or a particular era or something that was going on in your life? I always associate it back to either a film that I was watching or a song that was playing at the time. And so I can pinpoint, kind of even going back through the Leader Dogs timeline over the last couple of weeks, I can go back and remember, okay, this was happening at this point, this band you guys opened for. So I know that it was roughly within this, within this 6 month window, because I really do measure my life by the music that was part of what was going on at the time. So, yeah, Bill Withers, that was a big one because it happened kind of during this bizarre pause. And I really feel for people who are losing people during this time, because it's not the traditional way of being able to go and have a service. Aretha Franklin's a perfect example.
Right.
I mean, Aretha laid in state for like 3 days, and everybody flew into Detroit to be able to be a part of that service, to remember her, to pay tribute. And so you have somebody like Bill Withers go during this time, and I'm kind of aching for the fact that there may not be that kind of a celebration of his life.
Right.
Because by the time we all go back to relatively normal, there will be a list of people that, are all of equal stature that have gone through that. But Bill Withers is one of those people that it's the earliest musical memory that I have in my life. My parents had this album called Still Bill, and it was LP, and they played it all the time. They played it, you'd flip it over. Sometimes it would repeat on the same side. They'd flip it over, listen to it again. And it was the earliest songs that I remember. And it's hilarious because I was probably 3 or 4 or 5 at the time. And I knew all these songs and I knew the words. And there's like at least one or two that are about breakups and about, bad breakups. And there's one song called Who Is He and What Is He to You? And Bill just asking his girlfriend, like, what's going on here? They gave you a look. And I'm like, I knew all the words of that song at 5. And if I had known, I think it's hilarious now. I don't know if I was singing them through the house, but they probably weren't the best. Not that there was anything rude or about them, but it was just kind of like, it was subject matter that I didn't even understand until I was like 25.
Sure.
For sure. So,
and I just realized what it means a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, really? That recently? Oh, it is one of those songs where you're like, oh, wow. Oh, that's what's going on. It's like what's going on, right? But
so exactly. Anyway,
I listened to that album, and I just, what I liked about Bill, and I didn't even realize this until years later, was that Bill Withers was the kind of an artist that he was a black man, but he didn't fit necessarily Motown. He didn't fit, R&B per se. He did most of his stuff. The greatest thing, provide the link. You can go on and watch Bill Withers on Soul Train, and he's on the stage with an acoustic guitar. And if you've ever seen the show Soul Train, that wasn't the norm for Soul Train. It was just, booty shaking and rump shaking and all that kind of stuff. So it was kind of funny to go, even Soul Train wanted him on so bad that they were like, oh, we can take a break from our normal format and have this guy sing these songs, because just the two of us, Lean On Me, Who Is He, Ain't No Sunshine. There's such a massive list of songs that he wrote and influenced and was a part of. And he's also what I thought was cool. So what it showed to me is that as a black man, I didn't have to be pigeonholed into a particular type of music.
Right.
I can go to a metal show and have a great time. I can go to a punk show, have a great time. I even every once in a while will go to a country show and enjoy myself, enjoy the performance, enjoy all that kind of stuff. But there's nothing, there are several points in my life when I've been in a rock club or somewhere else, and I look around and I'm the only brother in the room.
Sure.
And it's never made me feel awkward or out of place. Cause it's like, well, if Bill Withers could play anywhere, then why can't I do the same thing?
Yeah.
Extremely liberating.
Me and the
security guys. and Doug Pinnock. Every time I go see King's X, Doug looks over the audience. He's like, oh good, Ryan's here.
Okay,
I always get that look like, Good. We're good.
Right. Reminds me of a story. When I first met you and you were coming over to Detroit for shows, and you brought Regan one time, I believe it was Regan that told me, like, we got into a show. I think you might've went over to like a merch table or went to the restroom or something. And Regan said,
okay, yep.
Hey, LP, could you just make sure that you stick near me because I'm the only tall guy here.
He's like, spoken code.
Got it.
My mom taught us that code.
Yeah.
The code wasn't say I'm the only, the code was not to say we've broken the code. The code is not to say, look, I think I'm the only black guy or brother here. The code was tall. Oh, I'm the only tall person. And you were taller than Regan. So
I knew straight away what was up for sure. So Bill Withers is on Soul Train. It gives the people a tempo break to slow down and like wipe away their sweat because it's not quite the same sort of energy level. Where does it go for you from there?
I think the first concert I went to as a kid was Andre Crouch and the Disciples. And if there's going to be one concert that you start your whole musical life on, that was one, because it was fixed. Like Bill Withers, it was fixed for a time. Bill Withers is cool because Bill Withers got to a point in his career around 85, 86. He's like, I'm done.
Yeah.
And he stopped recording. Like he recorded on his own. He produced some artists here and there, but he said, I've had enough of the music industry. He was like a aircraft aviation mechanic and literally, after he recorded and started to have hits, he was still working as an aviation mechanic. And, but he decided, okay, I've had enough. Like, it's been good. It's been okay. And then at 85, 86, he stopped, you know, being Bill Withers for the world to see. And he just kind of semi-retired and did whatever he wanted to do for the rest of his life, which was cool.
Yeah.
And in the same way,
just a quick aside about that, Ryan, if you Google Bill Withers samples, you'll get so many returns with like the 10 most, you know, biggest rap songs influenced by ear, where people sampled. There's one sample in particular, and I can't remember the song title, but one sample in particular where they show you like at minute 1:40 or something, there's like a little drum break, and that drum break has been used for like iconic, you know, rap songs over and over again.
Over and over again. Yeah, absolutely. And he was the first one to come up with it. Yeah, he has there's a Canadian DJ called Scratch Bastard, and he did a half hour like right after you've heard of him.
No, I think it was sent to you. Yeah, you sent the link of him playing Withers for like an hour, wasn't it?
Well, it's Withers, but it's also Withers and everything else, or a lot of the stuff he influenced.
Right.
So he starts with Withers' song, and then it moves into a song that you know that you didn't know was, you know, using a sample from Bill Withers. Right.
Yeah, that was brilliant.
If we could provide a link, that would be awesome, because it was so cathartic and soothing at a time when you couldn't openly mourn, and you know, at the time when he passed a couple of weeks ago. But I watched that probably three times through and just was like, yep, that's the legacy.
Yeah,
for sure.
I'll include it in the show notes for sure.
Yeah. So then I'm at a Andre Crouch concert at Ford Auditorium in Detroit, right on the river, inside, of course, but right downtown. And I was probably 7 or 8 at that point. And I remember distinctly what was the musical vibe in that room and how Andre Crouch was so good at combining gospel and mainstream and getting people into what he was doing. He was such a solid songwriter, like really just, you know, he could write stuff that nobody could. So I was early in life, I was exposed to two really good, amazing lyricists.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, lyrics are what I look for. I enjoy music to no end. But I love it when music and lyrics are married together in such a way that it creates a profound statement or creates something the mark for me is when I have to tell somebody else about it.
Yep.
Right.
That's good.
When I have to, it's not like I'm just going to sit on it. It's like, no. I heard this project and I think you'll really like it because I know your musical taste.
Yeah. That's good.
And that's where I'm at. So,
which, you know, actually let's take a quick, sponsor break here, Ryan, and then we'll get into your foray into DJing. How's that sound?
Sounds good.
All right, so just a quick break in my conversation with Rai Rai for a word from our sponsor. Okay, and we are back. I am with Ryan Richardson up there in the old Windsor, where he reminded me that for us Americans listening, it's not all igloos and sled dogs, but...
No, so, but I had a lot of fun with that when I was a kid too, because I'd have people, I used to tell people, because we have a tunnel that people can go through to cross the border. And I would say, oh, we're like England over here. So you got to switch over to the other side. You got to drive on the other side when you get in the middle of the tunnel. And sadly, people would believe it. I think they all survived, but
it's a different Queen's English.
Made things a little hairy.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah, absolutely.
So before the break, Ryan, we were talking, we got a little bit through Bill Withers and his influence on you and then Andre Crouch. You were starting to say, or actually you did say that if a piece of music really moved you or an album really moved you, then that's it. The litmus test was, if I've got to tell somebody, then that's gold for you. So
it really is. Yeah.
So I got to imagine that influenced at least, and you know, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but tell us, why did you decide to become a DJ and at what age? Just DJing events.
I think I was 15 or 16. No, I just started driving. So I was 16 and I was asked to, if I wanted to help DJ for a roller rink in town. Kids, there used to be these things called roller rinks.
Tell us.
They were large oblong rooms.
Tell us,
that
Ryan.
Had nothing else but funky lights and disco balls. And we used to play music and people would skate around in a circle.
Couples only.
This is again before. But yeah, but couples. There was couples only. There was slow skate. This will be the last slow skate of the evening. Find that person that you're looking for and be brave. Get out there. Don't be shy. Ask that person if they want to skate with you.
This was hot on the heels of the hokey pokey.
I was responsible for many engagements and then broken engagements, but that's okay. But the reason I took the gig in the first place is because they were going to feed me and they're going to pay me, I think, $15 bucks for the night, and they let me in free.
And you gave that gig up?
Well, the demolition man actually caused there to be a break in the action when they raised the building. I thought that was, you know, a sign that maybe I won't go back there. But yeah, that was the draw. They were going to give me $15 if I cleaned the floor at the end. Like I ran the big broom across. Like I was basically a human Zamboni, and so I got paid a little bit of money and I got to get in for free. And then everybody was like, oh, you're the DJ. Ooh, that's cool. And there was an aura about being a DJ that honestly fed my ego probably at the time.
Sure.
And to this day, because I was DJing vinyl, to this day, every 2 or 3 months, I will have a dream where I wake up in the middle of the night and I don't have a song cue. it has been at least 20 years since I DJed with vinyl.
DJ panic.
And I still, DJ panic. Like everybody's waiting. Like people are stopped. Like you're supposed to keep skating. People stop on the skating rink and they're waiting for me to play another song and I don't have anything ready.
Rai Rai
and so it still causes
the
panic.
Dead air dream.
Oh, dead air is not a friend.
No bueno.
Of a DJ.
No.
So that led me to, I did that for a couple of years and then there was an opportunity to do a radio show. We called it the True Groove. And so my transition from being a roller skating DJ to a radio DJ was a big deal, which is great because I think as we discussed before, the radio station wasn't that big. It really wasn't a strong signal, but because we were at the border, we had more people listening in Detroit. Yeah. We had 12 people listening in Detroit and we had 4 people listening in Windsor. So, It tripled our audience. So then I started. And then what I found out is that when you become a radio DJ, you actually, the companies at the time, again, this is kind of the sweet spot of the industry. The companies would say, what do you need? And I'd say, what? And they'd say, what do you need? And I remember the first time I got in the mail 30 CDs just because I asked for them.
That's amazing.
And
that's
I a went. Great story. And what, inside that was Mortal. Mortal was one of my first 30, my first free, my first swag. So, you know, it's Mortal and Scattered Few.
Yep.
So
that's quite a crate right there. You could stop at those two.
With those two is enough, yeah. Right? And so I used to, Nick, I would literally leave work on a Friday. I get paid every 2 weeks and I would leave work and I would drive to the local store and I just like put my money in front of them and say, how much can I get for this? That was my way of buying music. I don't even think I paid for gas. I think I borrowed from somebody, but I would take my entire or like 90% of my paycheck and I would take it to the local record store and I'd say, how many things can I get right now with this shiny money?
So I was
spending my own money for years DJing, getting new stuff because the thrill of if you're a roller skank, I said roller skank. Oh my gosh. Yeah. If I'm a roller skank, which I was, but I'm reformed now. But if you're a roller skating DJ and you've got 300 people a week that are listening to, and they're skating to your music, right? It's almost like you have to go back in time to remember when this was a reality. But when you're playing music for 300 plus people, you got an audience that's right there. And I would go to Detroit because a lot of release dates used to happen earlier in the US than they happened in Canada. So I would play stuff and I'd be like, you probably can't get this for another 6 weeks in Canada, but I got it right now. And I was like, it was all because I made a trip over the border and picked up a bunch of new stuff. So it was cool to be a DJ, but then if you're playing stuff that people can't even get yet and you're letting them know about it beforehand, it was like a bonus. It really was. Every DJ wants to have stuff before anybody else does.
Yeah.
And that's what I found out with radio is that they were sending me stuff 4, 5, 6 weeks in advance. There was a point when I was getting 20 CDs a week average.
Oh my.
And it was awesome. That is awesome. I loved it.
That is awesome. And by the way, maybe we'll post a picture of what a roller skate is on our Instagram feed for people, nice. You know,
good. Just in case people need a reference point.
That's right.
Cause I'm like, oh, and then we used to have these roller skating rinks and the kids used to come and the bebop and the, and they used to have competitions and oh, it was great. Like I sound like I'm 100 years old.
Yeah. Yes. And do you remember?
Some of our listeners will remember.
Do you remember the first airplane flight, Ryan?
I do. I remember when they introduced talkies and you'd have movies that had sound.
Oh, that's good. So,
yeah.
So. Okay. So now you're DJing a radio station. Now I've got to ask you this question because I kind of remember for myself, but the first time you walk into a radio station and you see how very different the gear looks from DJing at a, you know, roller rink, what's your impression that you remember?
Our first show, they gave us kind of it was great. They gave us a rundown, and it was college radio. So it wasn't, it wasn't paid. It wasn't commercial or anything like that, but they gave us easily a 10 minute how to run the studio in our absence meeting. And I know I didn't take notes. So we get into the studio and we put on our first record and we're like, yeah, this is the show we're doing and this is who we are and blah, blah, blah. The cool thing about getting the show in the first place is I got the show because I played them Scattered Few because they were afraid we were doing like this kind of Christian music type themed show that was a groove oriented show. And they were like, no, that won't fit our format at all. And then I played them Scattered Few and then they were like, oh yeah, that fits our format. We're good. It was nice. Scattered Few got me about 4,000 CDs. So thank you very much to the guys. If you're
listening. And shout out to Gene Eugene.
And shout out to Gene Eugene, who is Canadian and gave me all my Canadian content, which was great.
And didn't he produce that record, the Scattered Few record? I'm pretty sure he did.
It was he and Terry. Yeah, he and Terry Taylor did that.
Okay.
But so being on a radio station in Canada, there was a requirement, which there still is, to have a certain amount of Canadian content.
Nice. Good.
Okay? So, which is good, except all there was Angelica and Daniel Bay at the time for the stuff we were mining. And I met Gene at Cornerstone 1 year and he said, I'm Canadian, right? And I said, what? Like? He said, I'm from Fort Francis, Ontario. And so everything he recorded, everything he produced, I would list as Canadian content. And I'm sure if they checked it, they would be like, no, it doesn't qualify, but I don't care.
I mean, it had the Canadian touch.
It got us through.
Arguably, it had the most important touch, which is a producer's touch. So,
A producer's touch. Absolutely. Absolutely. So I'm forever grateful. So between Scattered Few and Gene, like you said, I probably got at least 4,000 CDs over the years. So thank you very much. every once in a while, I still got one in the mail or a book or something. Anyway, so yeah, so we're doing the show, and it was such a, it kind of leads up to where we kind of converge, because I was going to law school at the time while I was DJing, when I was doing the show as well. And so I was learning, I learned all about, as much as I could, about entertainment law. And the bonus of being in a border city is that entertainment and sports law were not offered at the University of Windsor. But if I wanted to go over like 10 minutes from my house to University of Detroit, right downtown, I took entertainment law there. I took constitutional law. I took sports law. I took copyright. I took trademark. I took all the intellectual property courses that I could, and they counted as credit towards my law degree.
So
I sat in with lawyers from Sony. Oh, I sat in with lawyers from, do you remember WHYT in Detroit?
I don't know.
It was a radio station. It was like the top 40 radio station. And there was a DJ on the station, and her name is Lisa Lisa.
Oh, I remember that. I remember and that Lisa name. Lisa was, I remember.
You remember Lisa Lisa?
Yep.
So I'm in my second day of classes in entertainment law at the University of Detroit, and this woman starts talking, and I'm like, I recognize that voice, but why do I recognize that voice? So Lisa Lisa, after she left the radio industry, she became a practicing lawyer. So she was in my entertainment law class, but she had like the raspy radio voice and all this kind of stuff. It was
a riot, great story.
I was like, I'm in a class with Lisa Lisa, not Lisa Lisa from the cult.
Oh, right. No,
mind you, but Lisa.
I remember
Lisa.
Specifically in and around the Detroit area, and maybe it was just from you, but I remember hearing the name DJ Lisa Lisa. So that's a classic.
But I have a feeling though that there was probably a Lisa Lisa in every city.
Sure. Yeah. Or a lot of people.
Crazy in the jam.
A lot of puppy dogs named Lisa Lisa. But so let's cap it off with this question, Ryan. What drove you? When did you get the idea? Maybe I'll go into law, and I want, and specifically entertainment law. What was behind that?
So I'm in law school, and I'm traveling to Nashville because I'm in the radio biz. I would get introduced to people as, oh, Ryan's big in Canada. No, I wasn't. But it's the credibility factor, sure. Right? I learned this in that time, and I've learned it more since then, is that if somebody's vouching for you, that will take you so much farther. And so when I had radio reps introducing me to Mortal and saying, hey, Ryan's playing your stuff in Canada, and they're like, oh, they're grateful. They're like, thank you so much. We didn't think we'd get airplay in Canada. You would have thought I had control over all of Canada's radio airplay, and I was a monster station, and I wasn't. But because the radio person was telling them, Ryan's playing your stuff, and they weren't really saying I was huge in Canada, they were just saying Ryan's playing your stuff in Canada, it made me connections that I have to this day. I'll go down to Nashville now, and I probably have 30 people still in the area that I can get together with and call and hang out with that I met in 93, the first time I went down to Nashville. So I'm down in Nashville, and I'm talking to artists, and again, they find out I'm in law, and they start talking about their contract. And 95% of them were talking about how bad the contract was, or how restrictive it was, or, you know, they promised us this, but we didn't get that. The music industry itself, in its original form, was such an insidious setup. And I don't say this lightly, because you had your artist and repertoire people, you had your A&R, and they were the ones that would go out and try to find artists to sign to a label. Okay. Then you have the label that says, yeah, whatever they said, they promised you, we're going to do. And then 6 months later, the A&R person that was your champion, that was right in front and saying, hey, we're going to do this. We're going to take you this far. We see potential for this. Yeah. They're gone. Right. And I thought about that, and I thought, man, what a flawed, sad structure. And then I went, no, for the labels that worked really well, because the A&R person really in the traditional form was to go and lure you to sign away your talent.
Yep.
Right. Whatever you do is ours. So you had this person that was your friend, and they were taking you out to dinner, and they were, you know, telling you how great the label was and how in 3 years, we're going to take you here, but they weren't even there 3 or 4 months later. And that, if I look at one pattern in the music industry, that is certainly one that I saw over and over again through no control of their own, right? I don't knock the A&R people, because they earnestly believed they could deliver on what they were going to do, but the labels really used the A&R people to get alongside and say, hey, come on, let's do this. So I was seeing people signing contracts that should have never, they should have never signed. I remember I did a phone conference for a band one time, and it was all their, they were in their teens, like they were late, 18, 19. So at the phone conference, their parents were in the room too. And they sent me their contract in advance, and I read through every paragraph and I went, you shouldn't sign this. Like in my head, I was like, you shouldn't sign this as it is. I went through every paragraph and hacked up on the phone. Like I could feel their dreams dissipating because they had been given a contract by a friend who had said, I'm going to start a label and I want you guys to be the main guys on our label. And I realized that he didn't have what it took even to deliver what the contract promised.
Sure.
And so the reason I got into entertainment law is because I was seeing scenarios like this where people had signed away their intellectual property and had no control over what was going on. And the label really wasn't doing anything.
Yeah, that's a great.
So that's why I got it. I wanted to protect artists from that kind of stuff, right? Understand the value of what you bring to the table.
Yeah, it's a great story. And honestly, Ryan, I think at some point in time in the future, maybe 4 or 5 episodes from now, we should go a little bit deeper into exactly that, the mechanics of the relationships between the artists and the label, because I think for the people who, you know, just like to listen to music and they don't fully understand those things, I think it would be interesting for them to hear. There have been documentaries like on, for example, 30 Seconds to Mars and their whole story about being That's bound, you know, to a certain contract and how it just, it's amazing. And of course, a lot of that has changed. Some of it hasn't because we're in a more independent era now for music, but let's definitely put that on the docket for like a, you know, 3-4 weeks out after we get kind of through the history, because I think that I don't know if the listeners will be interested, but I sure will.
Yeah.
Because I think it's a,
I got passionate about it.
Yeah.
Like I started to see what was going on and how the system was really screwing over artists. And I got passionate about not letting my clients go through that.
And I'm glad that you got passionate about it because it was one of probably 2 or 3 touch points that you and I had in how we met. But before you and I even met, you know, face to face, I think it was Dwight that had sent you, or that's what you recall. Dwight Mormon had sent you the contract looks like.
Faxed it.
Yep. And for those who are listening who don't know what a fax is, we'll put a picture of those machines right next to the roller skates,
please,
on Instagram. But
I don't even remember.
But yeah. So you reviewed that contract, and this was probably 6 months before you and I actually met, maybe even longer. We'll get into that story. Cause I think what's up next is, you know, for next week would probably be Jeff. And then the week after that, how you met Derek. And then we'll go into how you and I met. So let's end up real quick here, Ryan, with a recommend. What do you got as a recommend to leave for our listeners?
You know, from our discussion last week where we started talking about the unique opportunity that artists have in this time where everybody's a captive audience right now, I really like what some people are doing out there to be creative and not just sit on their hands and engage their audience. So I would recommend Michael Rowe from the 77s. Mm-hmm. He's done this thing he's calling the Coronavirus sessions. And he's recording like an hour on Saturday nights of just he and one of the other guys in the band just doing their hits and talking about the songs. And it is really warm and really inviting. And you can actually PayPal or Venmo him a tip for playing for the hour. And he was saying today, the one he did last night, he said last week, he said it covered a lot of their bills and just from one night. So I recommend people check out the artists that are taking advantage of this situation and getting out there in contact with their fans. And Michael Rowe and the 77s are one of them.
Absolutely. I'm glad you told me about that because I didn't even, you know, obviously know that was going on. I think for my recommend for, and also coming from our discussion is going to be, I'll try to find a link to the first album from Mortal. I remember seeing Mortal I wasn't all that familiar with them when I saw them at Cornerstone. They were like a midnight show. I think they might have even, it might have been like a reunion. I can't remember for sure, but
yeah, they were on late night, and I remember the first year.
Yeah, yeah. But I just remember going to that show, and probably for the I can't really say that because I was really into punk in the early 80s, but in terms of like going to an electronica show, feeling this real sense that somebody could die tonight. So
yes.
I mean,
yes, you're absolutely right.
So much energy coming from the stage and so much art. Uh-huh. Not just the music, but like their light show and the way that they, oh my gosh, I got to go backstage. I don't even know how or why, but I was able to watch them from backstage. And, you know, they were playing their individual instruments so hard that the risers would like bounce with them on, you know, at tempo, because like they would like, you know, put their full force down on a guitar or whatever, and the riser would just sink 3 or 4 inches. And there was just a lot of great energy. I can't remember the name of the first album. Do you know it?
I think it was just, was it just called Mortal? No.
Oh, you know what? I'm seeing Lucis. Lucis.
Lucid. It was Lucis. Lucis. That's what it was. Yep. Yes. It was Lucis.
So I will put
a
link in there for
find that one. Yeah. Because that I agree with you. That album changed everything.
Yeah.
On so many levels.
And changed your life too.
And their label story is not. And changed my life, but their label story was not good.
Yeah. I know that. Yeah.
Firsthand. So.
Well, Ryan, this has been a very good conversation. I think it's going to, you know, set the stage for what's ahead in the kind of the history of Leader Dogs for the Blind. So, and by the way, everybody listening, do if you've got a, you know, 35 minutes to spare, listen to our previous episode, season 2, episode 11, because we are starting to get into some of the brass tacks now, some of the mechanics of putting together a follow-up record to Lemonade. Ryan bought the URL. I'm going to be putting together a little one-pager website. Jeff, while we were on the phone, got us, you know, in line with some of the socials. So
we're soon, on Instagram. So
yeah, we're on
join
Instagram.
Join us on Instagram.
So very soon, there will be, you know, ways to connect with Leader Dogs for the Blind online. So
we're back, baby. We're back.
We're back. We got the band back together.
You know, I this is a line I've been working on for a while. Guess who's back? Back again. I think that could work. It's never been used.
Keep working on it, Ryan.
Keep working on it.
You've got 7 days to work on that. No, I'm just kidding. That's good.
7 days. In 7 days.
All right. That's a wrap for our episode today, April 19th, 2020. Thanks, everyone.